Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Gentlemen, this is Richard Martin here from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, and this is the first of my talks over the next few weeks that will be addressing some of the issues that are of general concern and general interest in terms of what you might do and how you might organize yourselves to confront this searing and very grim coming depression, or depression in which we are already situated, depending on how you care to look at it. I thought I'd start with an assessment, an overview of how migration flows are proceeding, given the very profoundly changed economic situation in the world today, and of course with my own changing situation in progress, it becomes more relevant to study how things are progressing so that you don't have any false expectations of how things will be in the future. And if you are listening to this from a foreign country, then you yourselves will also be able to put into much greater perspective, hopefully, how things will look in the future for you in your own particular country. The most important element, I think, to understand in the question of the flows of people from one part of the world to another is that the developed world has obviously for decades offered perhaps a difficult but a promising path to upward mobility, appears on all sides now to be losing its allure. Unemployment is rising in a way which is quite exceptional in the last 60 or 70 years. Backlashes, serious backlashes against foreign workers are mounting in all of the developed countries, I think I could say almost without exception. And the result is potentially the biggest turnaround in migration flows since the Great Depression, according to economists. Full migration numbers for most countries are only available after a long lag, and so they don't yet capture all the effects of today's economic crisis. But anecdotal reports from data from government ministries and outside organizations indicate that the flow of immigrants from poor to wealthier countries is slowing significantly for the first time in decades, while more people are returning home. Just to give you some examples of the kind of what you might call returnees, road builders from Bangladesh, domestic servants from the Philippines, factory workers from Indonesia and Vietnam, construction workers from Mexico, as well as bankers, lawyers, other professionals, real estate brokers, from all around the world. And they're basically moving even from countries like Singapore and Dubai. Singapore, where I'm headed, is almost a one-way street right now of people returning to their home countries. Immigration from Mexico to the U.S. dropped 13% in the first quarter of this year compared to the same period last year. And there are now more Mexicans leaving the U.S. than coming in. The joke is that it's Mexico now that needs to build a wall to keep the returnees out. Indonesian authorities expect 60,000 or more citizens to be sent home from Malaysia, South Korea, and other wealthy neighbors this year as immigrant workers lose their jobs. Tens of thousands of Indians are washing their hands of Dubai as jobs there dry up and work permits expire. And in the UK, the number of registered workers coming from the new European Union member nations like Poland and the Czech Republic dropped 55% in the first quarter of 2009 compared to the same quarter a year earlier. A growing number of migrants are returning home to places as diverse as Nepal and Tajikistan, while many are deciding not to emigrate to begin with. That comes from Dilip Rafa, an economist and migration expert at the World Bank in Washington, D.C., citing reports from ministries and embassies. Mr. Rafa calls this reverse migration very new and unprecedented. Well, now, clearly such migratory shifts could have profound consequences for developed nations, especially in places where domestic populations aren't growing fast enough to fill jobs or pay for social needs. High-skilled immigrants are an important source of tax revenue in some cities, and their kids fill the classrooms of universities and private schools. In the developing world, remittances sent home by migrant workers are also slowing, meaning less income and potentially less growth. Some analysts question whether the latest migration reversal will outlast the current recession or turn out to be as big as migration experts predict. Many immigrants have worked hard to establish themselves in their adopted countries and will be unwilling to leave, even if jobs disappear. Others say the trend could be more long-lasting, especially if returning workers help give developing country economies a boost or if rich world economies take many years to recover. Workers like Mexicans coming in from the United States all over the world are going home voluntarily, betting that for all the problems back at home, their native countries offer better options than the United States and Europe. Many developed countries are contracting, but some developing countries, including China and India, are still growing. A senior research associate at Harvard, called Vivek Wadawa, recently completed a study on migration trends, and he had this to say. He said, in the past, when you came to the United States, you came on a one-way ticket on the Mayflower or Air India. But now there are many lands of opportunity. Mr. Wadawa himself emigrated to the U.S. from Australia in 1980, working at Xerox, then first Boston, before becoming an academic. And he says, in other words, I've been one of the people I am now researching. His study found that among Chinese nationals who emigrated to the U.S. and later returned home, 72% said they thought professional opportunities were better in their own country. Among Indians who returned home, 56% said so. Mr. Wadawa estimates that as many as 200,000 skilled workers from India and China will go home over the next 5 years, compared to roughly 100,000 over the past 20 years. Kong Weipeng is one example. A native of Shandong province in eastern China, Mr. Kong followed a well-worn path of dreams to the U.S. after graduating from Beijing University in 1997. He got an advanced degree in financial studies in Pennsylvania State University and landed a job as a trader at Bear Stearns in 2004. When J.P. Morgan assumed control of Bear Stearns last year, he says he had the option of staying, but he decided to go back home. He said, I think the capital market in China is just rising. It's hard for Chinese to fit in to the local community entirely. In the U.S., he says, but my parents are still in China. Mr. Kong is 33, and he found an investment, a job at an investment fund in China, and left New York last fall. Well, in a general sense, economists believe that the biggest surge in world migration came in the late 19th century, when millions of people fled Eastern Europe and the Mediterranean to resettle in North America, Australia, South Africa, and South America. Thanks to advances in communications technology and the ease of international travel, a second and possibly much larger wave of migration began 100 years later, around the time the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. Migration levels soared through the end of the 20th century and into the early years of this decade as rapid economic growth led to rising demand for foreign workers. The U.S., U.K. and Canada once again became big receivers of foreigners, as did the UAE and other newly wealthy countries. The percentage of immigrants in America's labor force rose to nearly 16% in 2007, from about 9% in 1990, according to Mr. Wadhwa. Well, now some of the world's biggest magnets for foreign labor can no longer accommodate the influx. The population of the United Arab Emirates, and especially Dubai, have swelled in recent years from the hundreds of thousands of Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, Filipino, and Sri Lankan workers who came to build gleaming new skyscrapers and staff malls, as well as Western professionals who moved there to work as lawyers and bankers. But as growth in the UAE slows and more migrants return home, economists expect the Emirates' overall population will stay flat or decline this year after growing more than 6% a year in 2007 and 2008. And then we come to Singapore, whose push to attract immigrants has had as much to do with a construction boom as with a bid to attach vigor to a slow-growing population. More than 75% of Singapore's population increase between 2003 and 2008 was attributable to foreigners, including many high-skilled workers attracted by the country's booming economy and low taxes, and that's according to Credit Suisse. But with job opportunities dwindling, as many as 200,000 foreigners may leave Singapore this year and next, according to Credit Suisse. And if that happens, it could have far-reaching implications for the local economy, including a drop in property prices. Enrollment in local international schools has already started to dip, according to local media reports. An official at Singapore's Immigration and Checkpoints Authority had no comment. In the UAE, the country's Minister of Labour said recently that he doesn't think the country's population will shrink this year. The country issued 662,000 new labour visas from October 2008 to March 2009, outpacing the 405,000 cancelled cards for the period, he said. In the U.S., long allure for Latin American immigrants, the number of undocumented workers from the region appears to have peaked and may now be falling, according to a recent study by the Pew Hispanic Center. The population of South Americans, for example, has declined by as much as 400,000 from a peak of about 3 million in 2006, according to Pew demographer Jeffrey Passel. Much of the declines are among high-skilled workers from Colombia, where the security situation has improved, and Brazil, whose economy has seen huge growth in recent years. Mr. Passel had this to say: "What we're seeing is the normal outflow of migrants leaving the U.S. to go back home and a huge drop-off in the inflow coming into the U.S. In the case of Mexico, Latin America's largest supplier of new immigrants to the U.S., data released this week by the Mexican government shows immigration to the U.S. dropped 13% in the first quarter of 2009. In the same period, more people returned to Mexico than left Mexico for the U.S., about 139,000 and 137,000, respectively. The migratory shifts are likely to continue as governments increase via restrictions or otherwise, make it harder for immigrants to enter and stay. Spain and Japan have offered cash incentives for immigrants to go home. Australia recently announced that it intends to cut its intake of skilled migrants this year by 14%. Malaysia has frozen work permits for foreign workers in some sectors of the economy and is asking employers to lay off foreigners before they lay off native-born residents. Abdul Rahman, a 28-year-old migrant from Bangladesh in Malaysia, recently found himself out of work, out of money, and doubtful that staying in a more developed country would lead to financial security for him and his family back home. After living in Malaysia for 2 years, he lost his job at an electronics factory months ago and was sleeping under a bridge in downtown Kuala Lumpur. He didn't even have the money for a plane ticket home. The shift in migration poses a new challenge to the promise of globalization. Many economists and policymakers have long argued that widespread labor movement is a win-win because it boosts opportunities for people from poor countries while giving rich world employers more options for labor, allowing them to increase efficiency and keep costs low. That, in turn, can keep inflation in check and contribute to higher standards of living. Many economists still believe that, but it's becoming harder to make their case as unemployment surges, income gaps widen, and homegrown workers increasingly view foreigners as competitors for scarce jobs. Fewer migrants could indeed help ease competition for jobs and take pressure off social services in well-off countries, but it will also create new challenges. Many countries, including Mexico, the Philippines, and Vietnam, rely heavily on money sent home from overseas workers. Such remittances are expected to decline by up to 8% this year, according to the World Bank, after rising to $305 billion in 2008, more than double the level of 2002. Rich countries could feel a pinch too. Immigrants make up a significant portion of the home buying market in communities from Sydney, Australia to Phoenix, Arizona. The loss of foreign workers could lead to inflation when economies recover, and some employers are forced to raise wages to attract native-born labor. A diverse pool of immigrants can also add to countries' vitality, bringing with them new ideas and innovation, says Mr. Wadhwa of Harvard. According to his research, immigrant investors contributed a quarter of global patent applications from the U.S. in 2006, while 52% of all Silicon Valley startups between 1995 and 2005 were started by immigrants. The question for many immigrants now is, do I want to spend the downturn here in the U.S., or do I want to spend it back home where it's worse, especially if it's going to be hard to get back into the U.S. later? And that's from Gregory Watson, a remittances specialist at the Multilateral Investment Fund of the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, D.C., who is skeptical that large numbers will return home. For now, Santiago, a 37-year-old Mexican migrant who declined to give his last name, is placing his bets on his home country. On a recent flight from the U.S. to Mexico City, Santiago wore a black leather jacket and cowboy boots and described how he had crossed illegally into the U.S. four times since 2000. The most recent trip was in the fall of 2007 to get from Mexico City to his job as a truck washer in Tacoma, Washington. Donning heavy overalls, a face mask, and thick gloves, Santiago would crawl inside the mixing drums of cement trucks and use an acid solution to scrub down the chambers that carry wet concrete to construction sites. Overtime paid $16 an hour, and until recently, he could rely on getting at least 32 hours of overtime weekly, pushing his take-home pay close to $800 a week. But the slowdown in local construction meant fewer concrete deliveries and less demand for truck cleaners. His employer cut overtime in January, causing him to reconsider his status in the U.S. Santiago had already been sending excess cash home to support a business there, a small fumigation service he started with his brother in 1997. Fingering a roll of cash in his pocket, he estimates his worth around $12,500. He says he's now returning home himself, quote, with my capital. Well, of course, figures are very hard to come by, given that those who entered the U.S. illegally are likely to leave the U.S. Without much fanfare. But I think it's safe to say that for the next few years, immigration problem will disappear from the radar of the U.S. political spectrum, and I'm not sure, frankly, if it will ever return. I, of course, feel that Singapore is an excellent choice demographically, because right now it is true that so many people are leaving the country that property prices have already plummeted. And although I will not be purchasing any in the near future, rentals have already followed suit and are down up to 50% from their prices even as little as 2 years ago. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Richard Martin, for those of you who are listening for the first time. As I said, this is the first of my series of talks that have been recorded during my absence from a convenient turret from where I may address you personally, although if there are significant factors that come to play in the meantime, I will stop what I'm doing, pick up a phone, ladies and gentlemen, and address you personally, but I don't expect that to happen. Summer is usually a very quiet time, politically, economically, socially. I don't expect things to be that much different this time round. But then, of course, expectations are meaningless other than for the fact that they very often offer excellent contrary opinion and contrary indicators, meaning that when you least expect something, it's most likely to happen. So we shall just have to see. Anyway, again, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, coming to you live, rather recorded, I should say, from the studios of Radio Network in New York City. Please don't call the show for questions, there being nobody to answer them, but you may email any concerns or questions or personal requests that you may have to me at the following address. And that address is rmartin@latamenv.com. Once more, my email address, rmartin@latamenv.com. Lataminv, that is Latin American Investments, I should imagine, for those of you who would like to put an imaginary name to the site. It's actually Lataminv, I-N-V. Once again, I'll give you the address. It is rmartin@latamenv.com. Okay. No phone number for the time being until I get settled in Singapore. And then you shall have a local United States number that you may contact me on. Okay. Let me talk a little bit now about the concept of the expansion and contraction of households with the credit cycle. The credit cycle is a very clearly defined cycle of growth and contraction. It's probably one of the more more competent cycles to work with, because it really gives a very clear and unambiguous guide as to where we're going. Remember, in our economy, credit is the engine that drives the system. It shouldn't be like that, of course, because fiat money shouldn't be holding sway and allowing banks to issue credit, which is, of course, money which doesn't exist. By definition, credit gives you the opportunity to use money which has been created for you for the purpose, hopefully, of adding to the economy. Of course, in recent years, credit has been given to you for the purpose of adding to your personal wealth simply by dint of buying things. That is not a healthy economic justification for the issuance of credit. But nevertheless, that is what you've been looking at as you go out and buy your latest SUV or holiday in the sun, or second home, you've been using money which doesn't exist, as I'm sure you are aware. The 80s, 90s, and early 2000s were, in fact, a time of household expansion. This was not always a good thing. Families broke up, men and women separated, setting up houses in different places. The average house size went up, all at the same time as the average number of people per house went down. But now those trends are reversing. Children are moving in with according to Bloomberg, and I quote, German exports in April were 4.8% lower than in March and 28.7% down on a year earlier. Officials' figures show this is the steepest annual fall since records began in 1950, although an official said that April 2008 had been exceptionally buoyant. End of quote. Meanwhile, from China comes news that the world's most dynamic economy has lost some of its old vim and vigor. Chinese exports are down too, 26%. Again from Bloomberg, China's exports fall by record after global demand dries up. There's a market watch story which begins, hiring plans stick at record low. Employers' plans to add jobs were at an all-time low in the second quarter. Now, according to Manpower's latest survey, they're still at a record low. And today comes word from that foreclosures topped 300,000 last month for the third month in a row. At this rate, 3.5 million houses will be foreclosed this year. No jobs, no income, no income, no buying. No buying, no real boom. No real boom, stocks head down. Yeah. Congressman Paul Ryan said to Fortune magazine, and I quote, "This isn't a temporary stimulus, but a ramp up in debt, followed by a greater explosion in spending and debt. The bond markets will come after us with a vengeance. We are playing with fire." End of quote. Fortune says that over the next 10 years, federal deficits will add $90,000 in debt to the average tax-paying household's burdens, bringing the total to about $155,000 per household. Well, I think Fortune is underestimating. I think it's likely to be much, much more. You know, Obama may talk about taxing the rich. In fact, there aren't enough rich people to pay the tab for U.S. spending. The middle class will have to be put on the yoke. Alan Auerbach, an economist at the University of California at Berkeley, said, and I quote, "The revenues needed are far too big to raise from high earners. The government will have to go where the money is, to the middle class." The most likely levy, says Fortune, a European-style value-added tax, VAT, that would substantially raise the price of everything from autos to restaurant meals. But the problem, of course, is that the American middle class can't really pay these debts. They were living hand-to-mouth even in the bubble epoch. Now jobs are disappearing and incomes are going down. How would they possibly keep up with the interest, let alone pay down the principal on an additional $90,000? And that begins with higher interest rates, as lenders try to protect themselves from the risks of default and or inflation. And I quote from Fortune again, "The risk that the U.S. will follow Britain, which was warned recently that it could lose its AAA bond rating, has risen from virtually nil to a real possibility, judging by the sevenfold jump in the cost of insuring treasury debt in the past year. The big borrowing is already spooking the bond markets. This year, rates on 10-year treasuries have jumped from 2.2% to 3.7%. A further increase in rates would aggravate the situation, raising the interest costs on the debt and increasing its size even more." End of quote. Alan Meltzer, the distinguished monetarist at Carnegie Mellon, "I predict far higher rates over the next few years." And then again from Fortune, I quote, "Under George W. Bush, the U.S. experienced a prelude to the crisis before us. spending rose rapidly, while revenues remained reasonably flat. Bush created an expensive new entitlement, the Medicare drug benefit, cost this year $63 billion, and let spending on domestic programs from education to veterans benefits run wild. Over 7 years, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq added a total of some $900 billion to the budget. All told, Bush raised spending from 18.5% to 21% of GDP, setting in motion a chronic budget gap by piling on new spending without paying for it. Quote, under Obama, the Bush trend keeps going, but this time on steroids. So how many people do you know who have lived through a real bust? I don't mean the dot-com bomb or the Asian currency crisis, or even 9/11 or the 87 market crash, or even the 74 market meltdown or the late 70s oil crisis. I mean a full-on social and economic reversal. Now, quite frankly, it's becoming clearer to everybody, as it's been clear to me and hopefully to listeners of the wake-up call over these last few years, that we haven't seen anything on that scale since the great crash of 29, which we are beginning to see now and have been actually for quite a few months. Many of the witnesses alive of the events of 29, of course, are long gone. But you may remember your parents or maybe your grandparents talking about those times. They never seem to forget. How many depression survivors, for instance, still save scraps of paper and bits of string, rinse off tin foil, and wouldn't dare toss leftovers? You know, when you grow up knowing only good times, it's easy to forget that thrift and value were bedrock American values in the past. And it's still harder to imagine an America that returns to those ideals. But you see, it's not the little busts and downturns that change behavior. It's the big ones that do. And sometimes in long-lasting and very radical ways. Take Japan today, for example. In the late 1980s, you might forget that Japan was busy buying up American companies at a breakneck speed. They too felt pretty rich. We were sure that they were out to eat our lunch in the West. Well, then their market went through its own credit meltdown, just like the one we're seeing now, but on a much smaller scale. Well, they have yet to recover, not just economically, with a stock market that's basically flatlined for nearly two decades, but culturally too. Already, high Japanese savings rates exploded, car sales plunged by half and still remain low. Cabbage long ago replaced meat on Tokyo dinner tables. Middle-class Japanese started washing their clothes in used bath water. Are these destitute Japanese? No, this is the well-employed Japanese middle class with good jobs and incomes, but working and scrimping as though they could lose everything all over again. So what happens if the same consumer malaise locks into place here in America? A much longer recession or even financial depression than anybody is willing to imagine. Yet there's ample proof this is exactly the radical shift underway. In the bedrooms and the boardrooms across America, we're waking up to a very scary realization. All those big houses Americans bought, the cars and fancy techno gadgets, the fancy clothes and furniture, the $100 dinners and the $5,000 vacations. And suddenly, we're looking back and realizing they've got so little to show for it. Look, it's not hard to do the math. Over the last three decades, America's taken on one of the greatest industrial nations in history and traded it off piece by piece. In its place, the U.S. became the world's number one shopping nation. Not makers, but buyers. Even now, America is facing an economy in which 70% of its economic output depends on consumer buying. You have no buyers, you have no recovery. And yet, unlike other recent minor busts and even major contractions, the lesson hundreds of millions of strapped Americans are learning all over again is that same lesson that their forebears learned after 1929. And that is that the law of personal and financial responsibility is as irreversible as the law of gravity. And it's the egg that no bureaucrat, no matter how popular, and no multi-billion dollar bailout, no matter how large, can unscramble. In short, the hearts and minds of the American consumer have been thrown into reverse. And it's this total psychological snap that will make a back-to-baseline conventional recovery impossible anytime soon. This is vital to understand. Because, you see, a lot of Americans and a lot of people in the rest of the world are counting on credit card carrying American shoppers to jumpstart the global economic engine all over again. But it isn't going to happen. And you don't want to bank your investments on the idea that it will. Or you'll risk even bigger losses than many Americans have suffered already. Consider right now, total private consumer debt is nearly $2.5 trillion. How serious is that? Well, with the way trillion gets tossed around these days, it's hard to imagine. But you can already start seeing the massive paradigm shift taking grip when you look deeper into the day-to-day details. Let's look at some of them. On Madison Avenue in New York, shops that used to sell 2,390 dollar bedsheets and $2,400 handbags have packed up and slapped for rent signs in their windows. Penny pincher clubs are back. Coupon clipping sites are getting some of the highest traffic on the web. Discount sales and all-you-can-eat buffets have long lines going out the door. Last holiday season was the slowest in four decades. Meanwhile, luxury products are out. Showing off how budget-wise you are is back in. Big box stores continue to close at record rates too, while department store sales are down as much as 24%. The Gap, sales down 23%. Other clothing chains are down 22%. What's more, U.S. cars sell slower than in 1982, for the first time in history. China sells more cars than the U.S. does. Keep in mind, about 20% of all retail in the U.S. comes from car sales. That's 20%, ladies and gentlemen, of an economy which depends on 70% the consumer in this country. You know, planes can't sell seats in business or first class, not to mention a 20% drop in airline freight shipping. Meanwhile, train and truck shippers are in absolute freefall. Even FedEx and UPS, slammed by the double whammy of crashing buyer demand and no shipment digital book, document, and movie delivery, have seen overnight in shipping profits vaporize. You don't need to tell you that that adds up to trouble, ladies and gentlemen. The only question is, how much trouble? Total U.S. retail sales have rolled back to levels we haven't seen since 2005. Imagine if every single retail shop opened in the last 3 years shut down overnight. Every single retail shop that opened in the last 3 years would shut overnight. Imagine that. Well, it's already that bad. I'm sure you've read that since the start of the downturn on December the 27th, the United States is already out over 5 million jobs, losing hundreds of thousands more each month. So I guess the question on everybody's mind is, you know, how much deeper can this thing go? Well, the answer is that today's crash is already bigger dollar-wise than anything that was lost in 1974. And even back then, 1% of U.S. jobs disappeared. Do that today, and you're talking about a total of $13.2 million Americans out of work. That's 13 million people not buying cars or new houses. 13 million cutting back on groceries. 13 million not buying flat-screen TVs or going to strip malls. In fact, it's the same number of Americans who lost their jobs during the 1930s. You've seen the pictures of that. Even George Soros, the billionaire investor, says that there's no sign that we're anywhere near a bottom. And the jobs that disappeared were a multiplier effect that turned a stock market bust into a decade-long downturn. Today's record-setting job losses could very well do the same. The Alt-A defaults end in 2011. Now, I've talked about Alt-A before. Second line of mortgage quality buyers up after subprime and below the third line, which is the cream of the prime investors or prime mortgage buyers. The Alt-A defaults have started to rise. They will rise for the balance of this year. They will rise throughout 2010, and they will peak in 2011. Now, if you can imagine how many people lost their jobs in an ancillary profession to the subprime meltdown of 2005 to 2008 or 2009, where we are today, and that the aggregate effect of the Alt-A mortgagees is infinitely greater than the subprime ones, and their ancillary industries are much bigger and more powerful and more profitable than those who serve the needs of the subprime market, the mind absolutely boggles at the multiplier effect of seeing all these Alt-A buyers defaulting on their mortgages. And nobody is talking about this. You watch television, you look at the statistics, you listen to the pundits, you know, going off every day on CNBC with their plastic smiles and everything's going to be okay concepts. And nobody is talking about just how bad it's going to get from here. Never mind how bad it was in the past. It's a very, very frightening concept. And by the time you're listening to this, I'll be still in the United States, but traveling around to visit clients before I leave for Singapore. But I can assure you that the effects, the net effects of this recession are playing out very badly on the psyche of ordinary everyday Americans. You see it in your daily encounters with them. You know, they're short, they're sharp, they're impatient, they're upset. You can see that there is hurt on their faces, that they are in deep trouble already. And unfortunately, this is not the beginning of anything, not the beginning of a recovery. The wretched green shoots, they're brown weeds, as far as I'm concerned. And nobody is looking at these people. Nobody is paying attention to them. The government spends no time, it seems to me, looking into the needs of these people and how badly they're hurting. And one has to wonder what it will take for the Obama administration to come to terms with this and to deal with it. Because I see no sign that it's on the horizon here. So, this country is on a pace to lose 8 million jobs just this year, with the amount of jobs that have been lost so far in the first half. And by next week, you will have the figures for June, so you really will know the total figure for the first half of 2009, and it will not be a pretty picture. Right, well, you know, everybody seems to be talking about, you know, the new commodity bull market. I have no idea where that's coming from. General consensus is that the China growth story is responsible for this. Well, Chinese demand has indeed picked up, but not because of growth. The Chinese are hoarding right now. You know, if you look beneath the surface, according to Macroman, you see that a picture is developing that is much less unequivocally bullish for commodities, while overall imports have barely started to recover in value terms. Many commodity imports have absolutely skyrocketed in volume terms. And at the end of the day, the inputs to China's industrial and investment complex are based on volume, not value. Macroman ran a study looking at the import volume of four different industrial commodities, comparing it with the trend of 2003 to through mid-2008, which was the period in which Chinese growth averaged 11%. The results were remarkable. There is something else to consider as well, prices. In a free market economy, prices are a signal relied upon by both producers and consumers to adjust their behavior on the margin. This is how both supply and demand constantly adjust in a relentless search for equilibrium. When demand exceeds supply, the price adjusts higher. The signal to producers is to increase production and to consumers to reduce consumption. Rising prices, therefore, normally signal an expanding economy, in other words, growth. Well, currently, demand has continued to plummet or stagnate for commodities. However, prices have rallied, with oil hitting $71 a barrel. Well, this price is actually incredibly high if taken in a broader historic context, even more absurd during times of economic crisis. And the question is, if not demand, what then has driven a bid into commodities? Well, the economic crisis, while clearly global, has severely stressed the U.S. financial system. It is now feasible that the U.S. dollar will over time lose its reserve currency status. This makes the U.S. dollar less attractive and, by extension, less valuable. And since commodities are priced in U.S. dollars, a weakening dollar is expressed as higher commodity prices. Well, this was already happening before the economic crisis hit, and was part of the reason oil hit $147 the first time round. However, the dollar decline was temporarily interrupted by a safe haven bid when the global economy collapsed. The combination of demand destruction and a suddenly strong dollar crushed commodities, sending oil down to $33. Since then, demand hasn't recovered, and despite massive production cuts, oil inventories are at 19-year highs. But the U.S. dollar has started weakening again, and more importantly, is expected to weaken further in the future. Well, the natural hedge is to buy hard assets. This, of course, is nothing new. What is new, however, is that the U.S. financial position is now very precarious. Loose fiscal and monetary policies have deployed and most probably completely squandered an absolutely horrifying percentage of this nation's true wealth. This, coupled with the already well-documented demographic problem, as evidenced in healthcare costs, has made it starkly obvious that the U.S. will indeed face great difficulties honoring these truly monstrous debt obligations in the future. A very steep yield curve and rising rates on the long end of the curve are already signaling digestion problems. Important holders of U.S. government debt, such as China, have already started to voice their concern. Financing this exponentially growing pile of debt has really become a concern. Rating agencies have even voiced their concern over the golden AAA credit rating of the U.S. The only real solution for the U.S. as an eventual de facto partial default. This would occur in the form of both overt, buying Fed treasuries, and covert, manipulating inflation statistics. Either way, money will get printed and debt will get monetized. The U.S. dollar will fall in value relative to hard assets such as commodities. To complicate matters, it can, however, perform quite well versus other fiat currencies. A reduction of the debt burden to a level that is sustainable will suffice and probably be achieved in an orderly manner. Now, while rising commodity prices may indeed be signaling the return of some economic stability, they are also signaling something far worse. They're signaling that concerned countries are taking unilateral action to protect the wealth of their citizens by hoarding hard assets. Ironically, higher commodity prices are a form of tax. Remember that when oil first rose above $100, equity markets would actually weaken on days oil moved higher. When prices hit high enough levels, they went from signaling economic strength to signaling an economic problem. If anything in excess of $100 was a problem when the unemployment rate was 4.5% and credit was easily and cheaply accessible, what is $70 now? The unemployment rate is 9.4% and the financial system is crippled. Combine that rising interest rates on everything from mortgages to credit cards, and you've got yourself a real problem. And the real irony of it all is that the higher commodity prices will destroy any of these ridiculous green shoots that may have sprouted, and it's all because the desperate bailout of the financial system has so encumbered it that no other outcome is possible. Forget about a V-shaped recover. Forget about a W. This is going to be an L recovery for quite some time. In fact, I would go so far as to say that you're really talking about a total lost decade at this point. You know, again, I remember as the economy was heating up and the concomitant debt situation got worse and worse, the more heated the economy became, the less they talked about the public debt. But it's really going to be overwhelming in the next 2 or 3 years. The new figures from economists at the IMF suggest that the public debt of the 10 leading rich countries will rise from 78% of GDP in 2007 to 114% by 2014. These governments will then owe around $50,000 for every one of their citizens. Not since the Second World War have so many governments borrowed so much so quickly or collectively beaten so heavily in hock. Today's debt surge, unlike the wartime one, will not be temporary. Even after the recession ends, few rich countries will be running budgets tight enough to stop their debt from rising further. And what's worse is that today's borrowing binge is taking place just before a slow-motion budget bust caused by the pension and healthcare costs of a graying population. By 2050, a third of the rich world's population will be over 60. The demographic bill is likely to be 10 times bigger than the fiscal cost of the financial crisis. You know, this terrifying trajectory puts policymakers in an increasingly tricky bind. In the short term, government borrowing is an essential antidote to the slump. Without bank bailouts, the financial crash would have been even more of a catastrophe. Without stimulus, the global recession would be deeper right now, and it is a prolonged downturn that does the greatest damage to public finances. But the long run has it that today's fiscal laxity is unsustainable. Government's thirst for funds will eventually crowd out private investment and reduce economic growth even further. And what is more alarming is that the scale of the oncoming indebtedness might ultimately induce governments to default or to cut the real cost of their debt through high inflation. You know, these worries about default have been focused on weaker countries in the euro area, particularly Greece, Ireland, Italy, Portugal, and Spain, where the single currency removes the option of unilateral inflation. Ireland's debt was downgraded for a second time on June the 8th. Fears of inflation have concentrated on America, where yields on 10-year treasuries reached nearly 4% on June the 10th. And in December, the figure wasn't much above 2%. Much of this rise stems from confidence about the economic recovery rather than fiscal alarm. Yet the eye-popping deficits and the uncharted nature of today's monetary policy, with the Federal Reserve, like the Bank of England, printing money to buy government bonds, are prompting concerns that America's debt might eventually be inflated away. Now, whether this happens or whether it doesn't, and I certainly don't believe it's going to happen in the next few months, we have other considerations to take care of at that time. But whether those fears are justified or not, they will, in and of themselves, wreak damage. And there is no economic recovery. It was stillborn before it began. Today's policy remedies could become increasingly ineffective. Printing money to buy government debt, for instance, will send long-term bond yields higher rather than lower. And the policymakers have no idea what to do. You know, they can't engage in a sudden fit of fiscal austerity. Even when economies stop shrinking, they will stay weak. Japan's experience in 1997, when a rise in consumption taxes pushed the economy back into a recession, is a reminder that a rush to fiscal tightening is counterproductive, especially after a banking bust. Instead of slashing their deficits now, the rich governments are going to promise that they will do so once their economies are stronger. Well, how are they going to do that? Politicians' promises are worth nothing. Any commitment to prudence would have to include clear principles on how deficits will be shrunk. There would have to be new rules to stiffen the politicians' spines, and quick action on politically difficult measures that would yield future savings without denting demand today. Things like raising the retirement age. You know, governments should pledge to clean up their public finances by cutting future spending rather than raising taxes. But they will raise taxes. That will torpedo the economy. There's no question about it. They've always done it, and they will continue to do it. Oh dear, oh dear. Even in the United States, tax revenues add up to less than 30% of GDP. Raising taxes will not really do that much. Spending control should, of course, be the priority. But that's not going to happen either, not until this country is flat on its back. You know, they need to bring back the regulations. They don't need the new regulations. They need to bring back the regulations they already had and gratuitously abandoned. You know, they need to take these difficult decisions today. You know, they have failed to control the costs of aging populations for years. You know, it is frankly only the financial bust that adds so much debt that will bring people to their senses. That's why it has to happen. That's why it is a part of the cycle, the economic cycle, a bust. Comes after a boom, as night comes after day. You can't change the seasons or the order of the days, and you certainly can't change the economy. It's a very, very subtle condition, an economic pattern of growth and contraction. And I hope I've managed to give some flavor of what that economic contraction is going to look like and how it comes to be, ladies and gentlemen. I'll be back with you for the next show, which I believe should be on Thursday, if today is the 29th of June, as it should be. And I look forward to talking to you then. So take care. I'll see you then. Bye-bye now.